If you're an RIA, Schwab Advisor Services is the Watson to your homes. Smart, dependable, always has your back. With all the wealth services, technology, and support your firm needs, the difference is so obvious, it's Schwabvious. Follow the clues at schwabvious.com.
Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Ball 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday, good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Ball 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday, good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
We're talking about the Delphi case. Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, former chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, with us. Robin, when we talk about major investigative failures, they focus on evidence. What was tested? What wasn't? Who said what? Who did what? But beneath every failure is something far more than human. It's a psychology of the people involved. And when you read the Delphi depositions, the story that jumps off the page isn't just about evidence mishandling. It's about human beings under pressure, human beings making emotional decisions instead of analytical ones, human beings reshaping their own memories, human beings locked inside a dysfunctional leadership structure, human beings whose internal belief systems might have influenced the case more than the actual evidence did. So today, I want to strip away the paperwork and look at the investigators themselves, how they thought, how they reacted, how they communicated, and how this case spiraled into something that looks less like an investigation and more like a psychological implosion. So let's dive into this to begin with. From the behavioral science standpoint, what are the easiest and the earliest warning signs that an investigative team is beginning to fracture internally? And how do you see those signs in the Delphi depositions that have now all been released?
You know, and these can be really tough questions. And that's why I love your quote here, dysfunctional leadership structures. Yes, because basically what we're always looking for in any situation is we're looking for congruence of information, body language, behaviors, everything. We're looking for calm, basically, because anytime you're going to investigate something that creates a storm, you need a calm center so you can logically, methodically, go down the path of discovering the truth. And typically, you have a leadership structure at the top that is then dictating from their experience, from their reps, logical ways to proceed. And there are logical ways to proceed. You know, and when we do our show here, as soon as we have a case pop up, I have a procedure and a process in my brain I automatically go to for thinking about and regarding what truth is and how to discover that truth. And so what we see in this case from the very get-go was chaos. Mm-hmm. And so anytime you have chaos, the first thing I think of is we don't have leadership. And when chaos ensues, frustration ensues, not just frustration with the investigators, the prosecutors, the defense, and most importantly, the families and the victims of the crime or horrendous action that happened. And then you look at where you do have congruence of behavior or incongruence. And in this case, I have been from the very get-go and still hold firm to Richard Allen was nothing but congruence of behavior. He was very congruent all throughout this, even with, and we'll get to it if you want to, the supposed confession that he did to protect his wife and family, which, by the way, I did the research again on this. In the entire time that in recorded history of any cases I could look up and draw up in deep research with AI and everything else, there has never, ever been a confession that was given where his entire reason he gave it was to protect his wife.
At least not that there's been the record of that on.
And I said record, right.
Yeah, where that so, was the reasoning on, yeah.
Right. I mean, he was very clear in his courtroom call, I mean, his jail room calls and everything about his focus entirely all the time was his wife and family. Every single other confession, and there's only one other one, I don't remember the case right now, that came kind of close, but it was actually because of trying to self-protection. Because most of the time, people confess to protect themselves. They protect themselves to get a better deal, to lobby for something, for guilt, remorse. And what we saw here was not that. And that's why we have an incongruence of that behavior.
Yeah. I mean, that's a big thing. When you look at Richard Allen and you look at, if we go to that angle of looking at those interrogations of him,
yeah,
the way that he handled it, the way that he acted. And if you were to compare that to other cases where you have, and in most cases, you have an extremely narcissistic human being who is trying to justify whatever bullshit they did, whatever lies they're going to spew and whatever they're going to do. That was not Richard Allen. That was not that interview. That was not that same sort of guy. This was literally a guy who's like, I'm going to throw myself in front of a train for my family if I think you're the train that's coming at me. And he literally did. If we're talking about how this all played out, it is so diametrically different than other cases when you look at the character of the man who he is and the history of the man who he is. It's shocking how different it is. I don't really understand how some people can see it any other way.
Well, here's how. And this goes to the point of what you know, the opening question is, and this is the investigative team. And so he is now, granted, all things I always try to do is maintain objectivity at all times. I'm just saying, from a behavior standpoint, him being guilty is complete outlier from everything we're seeing behaviorally from him. Now, he could be an outlier. Outliers happen in society. They happen in nature. But in order to be convinced that he is an actual outlier, we need prosecution to allow everyone to see all the evidence that they have and allow defense to present everything that might be a mitigator of these things, to be able to talk about actual evidence that wasn't lost, interviews that weren't lost, confessions from other people that weren't able to be admitted. I mean, there's so much.
And let's talk about that, because there is so much chaos in this case. Two of the lead investigators can't even agree on a deposition in terms of, was the FBI fired from the case? Did they kick them out? Did anybody kick them out, or are they still there? If you can't even get the basics down of who's involved, who's sticking their hand into this cookie jar that you supposedly have all this control over, and you just want to make so local, and your two lead investigators have no clue who's actually coming and going, I mean, what the hell is that? I mean, either that's a cover-up of some sort and nobody knows what the official story is, or just extreme dysfunction.
Yeah, I mean, it's so hard to have conjecture about what they actually do. And I hate throwing law enforcement because they have a tough job under the bus. But at the same time, though, what we're seeing is what the appearance is of massive confirmation bias after pressure was put on after a number of years of not having any movement. For whatever reason, they put it on the back burner. Or I think it's just, I really think it's lazy incompetence. And why do I say that? I don't have a lot of data points, but when you look at the data points of how they conducted the interview / interrogation of Richard Allen, I'm like, these senior looking guys were horrible at the interview. And so that's a data point you're seeing with all these other data points of incompetence. Do I think it's intentional incompetence? Not necessarily. I just think they, you know, my technical term, they're being stupid. And I think they're going for a conclusion that they already had predetermined. And so when you have your own confirmation bias of what you're trying to see and what you're trying to find, you exclude everything else, or you make it easy to not find it. You make it easy to get rid of it. You make it easy for it to disappear. You know, and when you kick out objectivity, and this is what's really key in investigations, and we've seen this with other cases we cover all the time, including like the Epstein case. When you are so close, because it's a small town, and this is the case of the kid that was just all but acquitted of raping those two girls, you know, because the lawyer, I mean, because the judge lived there for 50 years.
In Stillwater,
In Stillwater, you wind up so close to the case that that's why you call in someone objective. That's why you call in the FBI. That's why you call in people that don't have a vested interest in the outcome. They're there objectively to be your loving critic. They kicked it out. When you kick out objectivity and you have that kind of confirmation bias in a small town and you're trying to serve, now, granted, I'll give them benefit of the doubt. They're trying to serve the victim's families. Okay, but now you're victimizing someone else.
Yeah. The Delphi investigators were staring down a furious public, literally years of no answers, national attention, years of dead ends, overwhelming emotional pressure. There's a lot that certainly was on them to try and get to some sort of an answer. And when we watch those interviews, and we're talking about what went on in the interrogation room with Rick Allen, they seem very confident in their ways. Now, it's easy for us to Monday morning quarterback it, or just, you know, look at it from, hey, here's what's effective, here's what's not. Maybe we should learn a little better ways of interviewing people today in 20 or whatever year this was when this took place. But they seem to be kind of stuck in a certain way of doing things. When we look at that, when we look at just how they handled it, these are folks that I don't think look back on their performance, and I'm going to call it a performance, and it's their interrogation. And I think I don't think they look at it from the angle you're looking at it from. I don't think they're looking back on that going, we could have done better. I'm going to guess they're still looking at it going, we knocked it out of the park.
Yeah. Maybe, most likely, who knows? But unfortunately, what you tend to do is you tend to be your own worst critic or not. But sure. Like in that interview, the likelihood of them looking at themselves too much is the problem, because what they weren't looking at was Richard Allen. And it's easy for people that are in that position to be the Monday morning quarterback, and then for them to call out someone like me being critical. And what I'm not doing is I'm not being critical, because that was a tough situation if they don't have a lot of reps doing that. But what they weren't really paying attention to, Richard Allen didn't spike their curiosity, because that's what you got to be as an investigator. And even there, if they went in trying to find truth rather than trying to prove he's wrong or get him to admit he's wrong, and those are two different things. When you're doing an interview, especially at the stage of the investigation they were with him, is when he says something or comes back with something, or more importantly, his entire demeanor is giving you pause and saying, I was expecting, if he's guilty, for him to behave this way. I was expecting denials. I wasn't expecting him to be so casual, so easygoing. So here's my cell phone, because he wasn't given the behaviors of trying to hide anything, of being obscuring anything. He was being as open and transparent as humanly possible. And they did a great job establishing an initial rapport, but they already had in their mind, he thought he did it. And so they went right to the accusatory, which is they lost. And again, we cover this all the time. When a human being, especially an investigator, loses their objective curiosity, you're sunk. Yeah. Because then you just trying to find the facts that support the conclusion you're going for. And I think that's what we started seeing very early on.
And they're human. I mean, it's in no way to dismiss it. But I mean, how does, you know, from an operational standpoint, how does long-term frustration warp an investigator's sense of what is true, even if unintentionally, when you're looking to fit something in this peg hole here, and it's a circle, and all you seem to have is a square?
Yeah. So what happens is the tribe mentality takes over. And what, you know, say you're in, so we'll do a thought experiment, which I'd love to do. So here you are, you're in a smallish town. Everyone knows each other really well. And people are getting frustrated. People you know are getting frustrated. There's a lot of local chatter going around. And people start needling you, poking at you, telling you how incompetent you are. And then most likely what happens is that someone comes up with a narrative. So Richard Allen, it wasn't originally even named, but Richard Allen lived kind of close. The possibility of someone locally, maybe someone who wanted to defend the fact that the next door neighbor was a convicted pedophile or accused of it or something like that, want to protect them. So someone puts in someone's mind, it's probably Richard Allen. And then that narrative in a small cloistered area takes a hold, takes effect, and they keep poking, they keep poking, they keep poking, till finally that's all that investigation team starts hearing. So they lose the objectivity of truth and trying to find the data to support that or maintain it open. And now they're trying to please a public that is calling for this specific thing. I mean, we see this on social media all the time. I mean, we consume information to validate our own self-opinion. And if their self-opinion became survival because they wanted to be liked, they feared being ostracized by the community because it's a small community. Who knows all these reasons? But when you are in a small community where a community loses its objectivity because they're seeking an outcome, which is just justice for the girls, and there's zero investigative progress because they were incompetent, then this is what happens. They locked onto someone, or someone in that community locked onto something, and the entire community got confirmation bias. And why do I think that? Because the jury found him guilty. That's why I think that.
I think one of the biggest questions in this case, especially today, now that we're looking back and we have all of the depositions, we have all of the evidence, including, we can see all the things that were not admitted into trial, especially all of the Odinism work. We're learning the FBI came up with the Odinism theory. The behavioral analysis unit came up with the Odinism theory, which is quite powerful. And then we also have two suspects early on. I believe they were suspects, and if they weren't, I apologize. But you have two individuals. You have one who had literal Facebook posts of girls, and if they were his daughter's friend, somebody, that were laying in on the ground in the wilderness with sticks. It almost looked like they were reconstructing the crime scene with Odinistic ruins on them. There was talk about this person being an Odinist. There was evidence showing that this was part of their belief system. It's up there. It's online. This is not made up stuff. This is a very peculiar, if you just had a murder and then somebody's posting on Facebook, almost like weird tributes to this. You also have another person who asked one of the investigators here, I believe it was Holder. I could be incorrect. But the question was, if I spit on one of the girls, on one of the bodies, could that come back to me? Essentially, could that get me in trouble? All of these things. The investigators that we're learning about from their depositions, they all said, stuff is inconclusive. There's nothing here. I don't know, like, how what you need. I mean, other than fireworks being shot at your head saying, hey, this is something right here that you should be looking at.
Yeah. Any one of those things should have derailed what they actually wound up doing. And so let's start off with first the BAU coming in and calling this Odinism as a theory.
Yeah.
They don't say things unless there's science and research to support it. So what the BAUs do, behavioral analysis units, and I was part of the behavioral analysis program. So I am always, as you all know on the show, I'm extremely careful because I don't call myself a profiler and behavioral expert because I ran our behavioral analysis program, which is a little bit different than the BAUs. Those BAU guys are so good because they base everything that they say and on science, research, and then they come with the conclusions. They use a very scientific method to come up with a profile of what they see given evidence and data. And as we saw in the yogurt murders years ago, the BAU came in, and because they didn't have enough data, they didn't give a profile of who they thought this was. And everyone was outraged that the profilers came in and they couldn't come up with the yogurt shop murders. They couldn't come up with a profile. Well, because they don't make wild ass guesses.
Yeah.
And that's why if they came in and said there's this Odinism thing here, you damn well better listen. Because they don't make shit up. And so they're based on research. And that research is based on prior cases they've seen. They just don't come up with a theory. If they've seen it a lot, it becomes part of a profile, part of the research. And so if they come in and say this thing, you better look at it. Then the other thing that is glaring to me, especially after having covered the Epstein case so much now, and that is if you have any male of an older age that has any images of any girls that are teenage and they're not his, you got an issue that you should be exploring, because that is not right. There's something creepy. And when you got creepy, that's smoke, and you got smoke, you got autism, we got something to focus on instead of, now granted, does that mean it's guilt? Does that mean anything else? No, but we got some smoke that needs a lot of looking at to see if it's a fire. And that's what they totally dismissed.
From a behavioral lens, what internal story, and this is just pure speculation on these investigators, because I'm trying to understand what the hell they were thinking. What internal story are they telling themselves to rationalize ignoring these red flag behaviors from other potential suspects, that even the FBI is coming to you going, hey guys, this sounds kind of crazy, but we're the FBI, look at this shit. And they're like, nah, we got it. We're good over here. We got tons of experience in homicide. Oh, wait, we don't. We have none. Oh, you have good. We got it. We're good. I mean, what's going on? What the hell is going on?
So let's place ourselves in those kind of situations. And that is, from my perspective and my optic, so here you are as an investigator, and these guys are trained. These guys have reps. They are objective when you start out. And then you have outside people like the FBI and others coming in and saying, hey, here's what we're seeing, this, this, and this. That is enough influence in your brain from your experience and from law enforcement that should be directing you down a path. And if all of a sudden that path stops and you redirect over here, I don't think these were internal choices. I really, really think that external pressure that was put on them by either community or superiors or both led them down a different path that they originally weren't going to go down, which we actually saw they weren't going down. They were actually exploring these things, and all of a sudden it went sideways. It's hard to imagine, because I can't, now granted, I'm doing my best to be that deep act of empathy where I'm placing myself in their shoes. If I'm in their shoes and I don't have external pressures, those are the paths I'm choosing to go down. You don't have to be a behavior expert. All you have to do is have access to the Google machine to see that Richard Allen's pattern of behavior does not fit other homicidal killers of girls. It just doesn't fit. And so when you have that non-fit, which is a very, very clear non-fit, and you have outside people telling you to look over here, a reasonable investigator is going to follow that path first to its full conclusion. Now, granted, it might come out like they might have found, like I said, Richard Allen could be that outlier. But the way to figure out if he's an actual outlier is you have to flush out the logical place to go first. Because here's where logic is when it comes to these types of murders. There's a connection to the girls, connection to the victims, basically. And you actually have patterns of behavior that might fit. You have people that have been accused in the past. You have people that have some sort of and there was a connection between one of the individuals that actually eventually, according to what we're seeing and hearing, confessed to killing the girls in jail. That's the pattern you go down. So the fact that they didn't says that I don't think it was internal to them, because any individual, just looking at as we laid it out here, just very basically, this is not complicated. You wouldn't do what they wound up doing. So the only explanation is they had outside influences that pressured them not to do that.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blast tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday, good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Extra Value Meals are back. For just $5, get a savory and sweet sausage, egg, and cheese McGriddles, plus hash browns and a coffee. Only at McDonald's.
For limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Ball 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Ball 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Ball 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Ball 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Ball 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details. Four seasons greetings to you all.